How badly has the civilian population of Yemen been affected by the siege of Saudi Arabia and her regional allies? Who is under threat from the Saudi coalition bombardment? What is the background to the current conflict? What role are foreign powers like the United States and Iran playing, and what is at stake for the broader region? On this week's episode of the Global Research News Hour, we examine the 2.5-month-long siege on Yemen by Saudi Arabia and its partners. We'll speak to an observer on the ground in Sana'a about the humanitarian situation there. We'll speak to Ethiopian-Canadian human rights activist Ali Said about impacts on African migrants. And we'll hear from Abayomi Azikiwe of Pan-African Newswire about the geopolitics of Yemen and the prospects for peace moving into this Sunday's peace talks in Geneva, Switzerland. On this week's show, Yemen, the silent slaughter. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 12, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Interviewed on June 6th by German Economic News, the chief economist at Bremer Landsbank, Volker Hellmeyer, says that because of Obama's sanctions against Russia, German exports declined year over year by 18% in 2014 and by 34% in the first 2 months of 2015, no later figures. But he asserts that, quote, the damage is much more comprehensive than these statistics show, unquote, because those are only the, quote unquote, primary losses, and there are, in addition, quote unquote, secondary effects, which get even worse over time. Why is there not in Europe a huge movement to abandon NATO and to kick out the U.S. military? Whom is the U.S. defending Europeans from after the Warsaw Pact ended in 1991? Why did not Gorbachev demand that NATO disband when the Warsaw Pact did, simultaneous instead of one-sided disbanding of the Cold War, so that there would not become the foundation for international fascism to arise to conquer Russia, first to surround it by an expanding NATO, and ultimately via TPP and TTIP in the aftermath? That comes from the article, German Banker, Obama is Destroying Europe, by Eric Zeus, posted June 10th. Hungarian news site Carpathier.com published several photos Tuesday of what appeared to be a NATO convoy concentrated on the Hungarian-Ukrainian border. The vehicles lined up in the Hungarian border town of Zahony, eastern Hungary, on Tuesday afternoon included Hummers and multipurpose variants of the U.S. Army's HEMTT eight-wheeled logistics trucks, some of them featuring tarps over their cargo. Border police declined to comment on the vehicles, and Carpathier could not determine the purpose or direction of the convoy. Zahony, located in the country's northeastern border with Ukraine, features road and railway crossings into the western Ukrainian border town of Chop. That comes from the article, Mysterious Military Vehicles Spotted on Hungarian-Ukrainian Border, by Sputnik, posted June 10th. In the past, IntelliHub News and others have confirmed that while the list released by the Bilderberg website does include many who will be there, it also leaves out those that would rather not have their name released to the public. It is also well known that whatever agenda is discussed at Bilderberg will have repercussions for the entire world for years to come. Perhaps the biggest piece of news coming out of Austria and Bilderberg 2015 so far is the fact that a major Hillary Clinton advisor is on the list and set to attend. Longtime Clinton friend and ally Jim Messina of the Messina Group will be attending the globalist conference where the globalist favorite for the United States 2016 election will surely be decided. This news indicates that the powers that be have most likely decided to back Clinton for president. That comes from the article, Bilderberg Chooses Hillary Clinton for 2016, by IntelliHub News, posted June 10th, originally appearing at DC Clothesline. A professor from Japan's Fukushima University Institute of Environmental Radioactivity, Michio Aoyama, told Kyoto in April that the west coast of North America will be hit with around 800 terabecquerels of cesium-137 by 2016. This is not news for those who have been paying attention. For example, we noted 2 days after the 2011 Japanese earthquake and tsunami that the west coast of North America could be slammed with radiation from Fukushima. We pointed out the next year that a previously secret 1955 U.S. government report concluded that the ocean may not adequately dilute radiation from nuclear accidents, and there could be, quote, pockets and streams, unquote, of highly concentrated radiation. The same year, we noted that 15 out of 15 bluefin tuna tested in California waters were contaminated with Fukushima radiation. That comes from the article, West Coast of North America to be slammed with 80% as much Fukushima radiation as Japan by 2016, by Washington's blog, posted June 10th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Saudi Arabia and 9 regional partners known as the Gulf Cooperation Council, together with logistical and intelligence support from the U.S., have been launching airstrikes against the Ansarallah fighters in Yemen since late March. The humanitarian situation is dire. A recent Oxfam situation report listed Yemen as the country with the largest humanitarian need globally. 20 million people, or about 80% of the population of the country, are affected by the conflict. 13 international humanitarian organizations are urgently calling for a permanent ceasefire, an end to the Saudi-led commercial blockade, an end to the arms transfers to the players, breaching international humanitarian law, and sizable increases in humanitarian aid and long-term development aid. To get a more detailed assessment of the situation on the ground, we are joined by Hisham Al-Omaisi. He is a Yemeni information and political analyst. For the last 2.5 months, he has been based in Sana'a and using social media to inform the larger world about the unfolding catastrophe there. We spoke via Skype on June 12th.
There's been quite a lot of airstrikes over the last little while, like last 24 hours.
Yes, there have been. Mostly at night, though, last night. Mm-hmm. The military police was targeted at a munitions depot in Fajatan, which is a mountain here in Sana'a, was targeted. The old city was targeted, which is a 3,000-year-old city in a very densely populated area. 3 houses were obliterated. 2 other homes were partially destroyed. 5 people were killed, and more are being pulled out of the rubble now.
So I wonder if you could maybe just to help our listeners understand, if you could maybe describe what it's like to be subjected to these airstrikes.
Well, we live in absolute terror. The airstrike, we didn't get any warnings before the airstrikes. The fighter jets suddenly appear in the sky, and they basically target pretty much everything. We don't even know what the targets are. They usually target weapons, munitions, military camps, homes, residential areas, offices. So you're not prepared. You don't know what exactly they're going to target, when. And to make things worse, Sana'a does not have bomb shelters, so you cannot run to anywhere where you can hide. Usually people hide in their basements, if they have a basement. and at a moment's notice, because we don't get sirens warning of the air raids.
So, and they're sporadic. They could come at any time, or is there a particular time of day when you are more inclined to hear them?
No, they're pretty much 24/7. Usually, they're more intense at night, but they could happen at any time. Some of the worst bombings happened during day, and some of the most intense, but not the ensuing explosions weren't as worse, were during the night. But again, there's no specific time to expect them. They're pretty much happening 24/7.
Have there been, that you've experienced, have you been pretty much in the same place for this whole 2.5 month long ordeal, or have you had to move around?
I had to move around a couple of times. You think one area is safe, so you move to it, and within a few days, that area is bombarded. You move to another location, and again, the airstrikes seem to be following you everywhere you go. Because the thing is, the airstrikes do not target just military camps in Sana'a. They also target some homes, some VIP people who are living in densely populated areas. Suddenly, they would target some unexpected location where they claim there's a hidden stash of weapons. So they're pretty much targeting everywhere. There's nowhere to hide, and you keep moving around, hoping there's going to be a safe area. And within a couple of days, you realize that area, too, is being targeted.
Do you, so the building you're in now, do you stay on the ground floor? Do you go underground? Do you stay at a higher floor? What's the most sensible place?
The safest place is the basement. I have a 3-story villa, but I never venture to stay in the second floor. I usually keep to the first floor, and as soon as I hear the fire just in the sky, I take my kids and I run to the basement.
Okay. So we're hearing a lot about the shortages of food and water and lack of access to medicines. How are people in your vicinity coping with those lack of basic essential items?
Well, we had some quantities stored, but over the past 2 months, we basically burned through those stores. Yemen imports almost 90% of its food, 100% of its drugs, and the vast majority of its fuel. After 2 months of blockade, the current situation is catastrophic. There was a statement by 13 NGOs, international NGOs, yesterday, where they said, if the blockade continues, there's going to be a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen very soon. And when I say very soon, I don't mean within a month. I mean within a matter of days.
Now, water in particular, is there any basic infrastructure there that's helping you? Have people have to rely on neighbors? How do you get hold of that?
Well, you have to remember, Yemen is a very closely knit society. So we help each other. So far, we've managed to get by everyone pitching in, and the neighbors helping, the community helping. But as far as water, for instance, we pump out the water using generators. The generators need fuel. The blockade is preventing fuel getting into Yemen. So it's becoming very extremely difficult to get water, let alone food and other stuff. And the water price that we used to get, for instance, for 2,000 riyals, which is basically $10, have now quadrupled in price. It costs $40.
Of course, electricity, it's coming from generators that you've gotten hold of.
Yes, because the national grid has been sabotaged early on by airstrikes. Any attempt to trying to repair those, and usually the fighter jets would show up within minutes and attack the repair teams. And it's becoming, of course, a problem because now we only get an hour or two of electricity every few days. And those are run usually by backup generators, which is run by the state. But again, the state does not have the fuel to run those backup generators. So people rely on their own personal generators. I, for instance, have my own personal generator, which I fire up for a couple of hours a day. But again, now that the blockade is preventing fuel from coming into the country, I cannot even find the fuel to run my backup generator.
So you could be effectively offline very soon.
That is very true. Previously, you would notice that a lot of people from within Yemen would be very active on the online, on the internet. But a lot of voices have disappeared because they can no longer afford to buy the gas, which has quadrupled in price and now basically unavailable. So they cannot get electricity to go online. The telecom infrastructure, the state's telecom infrastructure has warned that they're running out of gas to run their servers. So they'll soon be shutting down as well. And soon you will not hear from the voices coming out of Yemen.
What about healthcare facilities, hospitals? What can you tell our listeners about what's happening there?
It's a very dire situation. We import 100% of our drugs. Humanitarian organizations that have been visiting hospitals, they speak of horrific scenes there. You would rush a patient to the hospital after an airstrike by some miracle trying to get them to the hospital because there's no transportation, again, because of the lack of gas and fuel. So as soon as you get to the hospital, there's no electricity to run the sensitive equipment at the hospital. There is no drugs. There is no blood in the blood banks because, of course, the banks, they need refrigeration. And because there's no electricity, the blood goes bad within a few days. So you rely on volunteers providing blood on the spot. And, of course, the volunteers are hiding during the airstrikes. So it's unbelievably devastating. When you visit a clinic, you find a lot of bodies littering the floor and nobody can provide them with any form of assistance.
And in terms of the people getting ill, are people close to you coming down with severe illnesses?
Not in Sana'a, but they are in Aden. In Aden, dengue fever, it is widespread in Aden right now and they cannot control it. Basically because they don't have prevention means. Of course, there's no cure for dengue fever, but there are some drugs that could mitigate the symptoms and the effects. And people cannot access Aden. They have no electricity, and it's very extremely humid with 65% of humidity and almost 40 degrees Celsius, which is basically an ideal environment for the dengue fever to spread. And now there's an epidemic down there in other places which are more humid and hot than Sana'a.
Speaking of humid and hot, I mean, it's getting into summer now. I imagine it's not, it's getting pretty, I don't know, unpleasant. What can maybe give us a little bit of more of a sense for our listeners about what it feels like out where you are, some of the things that might be wearing away at your capacity to cope?
Well, the lack of food, the lack of water, the lack of internet, the lack of basic items. And on top of all of those, it is summer, it is very hot, it is very humid. And to top it off, you have airstrikes throwing bombs on your head 24/7 a day. It's honestly, there are people who actually wish they would die and get it over with. There are people who cannot afford this because, of course, the economic situation is disastrous currently. All the businesses have stopped. So even those people who could afford some of the items at quadruple the prices, they're running out of money. There's an increasing inflation. Aid is not coming through. There is no hope within the coming few days. With the political jousting between the different parties seemingly taking forever, it's a desperate situation. There's no light at the end of the tunnel, basically, for pretty much everybody.
You spoke earlier about how the people of Yemen just come together and network with each other. I'm wondering, though, if things have gotten to the point where people are starting to turn on each other. Can you speak to anything like violence or the human security aspect of it? Or is there any, you know, people trying to loot each other or anything along those lines that you're hearing about?
Unfortunately, that is very true, Michael. What you just described is happening right now in Sana'a. For the first time ever, yesterday there was an attempted bank robbery in one of the busiest streets of Sana'a, and three people were killed. This is unheard of in Sana'a. But a lot of people are now resorting to banditry. They're desperate. They're not going to die starving. So they will resort to thuggery, basically.
I remember I think I saw one of your tweets. You were talking about the use of child soldiers. Can you speak to that point?
Yes. It is a very complicated issue, with child soldiers in Yemen. You have to remember, this is a population where almost 60% of it is under the age of 14 years old. In Yemen, it is very common for kids to carry weapons. It's part of the culture. It's not something new. Now that Yemen is on the international scene, as part of the international arena, a lot of people are zooming into this phenomena and saying, you know what? This cannot go on. You cannot have kids carrying weapons. But because it was part of the culture for so long, recruiting kids into the army wasn't frowned upon. And that is why you see a lot of child soldiers. However, over the past 10 years, now that there's more education, there's more awareness, a lot of people are shunning away from that and trying to raise awareness that you cannot have kids, anybody under the age of 18, join the army. But, for instance, now with the Houthis, they're coming from tribal areas, remote areas, the hinterlands, where education is not widespread, where awareness is very limited. They still have a lot of people under the age of 18, carrying weapons and joining the militias. The world now, zooming in on to this phenomenon, thinks that the Houthis are forcing people to join, forcing kids to join. No, they're not. It was part of the culture since before, so they willingly joined the army, they willingly joined the militias. We're trying to limit that, but it's going to take more time, it's going to take more education and raising awareness.
Now, what are the thoughts of people around you toward the various factions, whether it's the Hadi-aligned forces or the Houthis or even Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? Do you have any sense of people rallying behind one or the other of those elements?
Well, to begin with, there are a lot of people who are anti-Houthi, but because Hadi basically skipped town and is dictating orders from Saudi Arabia, his rhetoric is basically of an utter disconnect with the realities on the ground, has forced a lot of people to entrench with the Houthis, even if they're anti-Houthis. Now, basically being in the same boat with the Houthis and being bombarded daily, now being blockaded by Saudi Arabia and Hadi, they are forced to join the Houthis, at least in principle. They're basically fending off for themselves. They're stuck in the same trench with the Houthis. As far as Al-Qaeda goes, they have very, very limited support in the country, basically in some remote areas down south. And of course, you have to talk about the resistance, the Harak, which is the southern mobility movements, and calling for secession of South Yemen. They do have a lot of support in the south, and that is because of the inequality and injustice that has been done to them since 20 years ago, since unification. And they rightly do complain of a lot of injustice done unto them. As far as Hadi goes in Saudi Arabia, he basically has no support here on the ground. A lot of people didn't really vote for him in competitive elections. He was voted into office through a deal that was basically dictated by the GCC. So he did not get into that post by popular vote. He's much, much less accepted now that he actually stood with Saudi Arabia and ordering airstrikes on his population, ordering a full commercial blockade, devastating the local population. Unfortunately, Saudi Arabia and the media still refer to the local resistance as being pro-Hadi, when those pockets of resistances across Yemen have repeatedly said that they are not pro-Hadi. that they are pro their own agendas. The Southern Resistance is pro secession. The people in Adal, they're anti-Houthis, fighting the Houthis to fend for themselves, not because they are pro-Hadi. Al-Qaeda and the Sons of Hadramaut down in the Mukalla area, which is basically the oil-rich province of Yemen, they fought off the Houthis because they wanted to instill Al-Qaeda type of rule, not because they are pro-Hadi. Yet you still hear media rhetoric talking about pro-Hadi forces on the ground, which is non-existent.
Joining us now is Ali Said. He's the General Secretary of the human rights group Solidarity Committee for Ethiopian Political Prisoners. And he's here now to talk to us about the situation facing migrants in Yemen. So thank you for joining us, Ali Said.
Thank you, Mike, for having me as usual.
Okay.
Thank you.
Could I get you to comment on the situation facing migrants there? Because even before the bombing started, things were not very going well for people in Ethiopian and other African migrants in Yemen.
Well, before the war started, and we were complaining, the situation about the Ethiopian refugees and other immigrants in Yemen, how they are suffering, especially in the refugee camp and in the city. So the refugees are being suffering for a long time there because nobody is trying to protect them. And as you know, the Ethiopian government has a relationship with the Yemeni government. So they are working hand to hand. So they are helping each other. So they are not, especially the Yemen government is not willing to help or support the refugees.
So what kinds of stories are you hearing about what's happening to the refugees in Yemen?
In Yemen, most refugees are being imprisoned and tortured and killed even before the war. And there is no financial or in moral support by the Yemeni government and also the UNHCR office there in Yemen. And we have been complaining for so many years, especially the UNHCR office, which is located in Africa, in Sudan, and Kenya, and particularly Yemen. And instead of working for the Ethiopian refugees there and for immigrants, and they are working for the Yemen government and for the Ethiopian government. That's also the biggest problem in African refugees. So we are asking, especially all Canadian to sign a petition which is organized by Ethiopian Orthodox Church here in Manitoba, here in Winnipeg, and also Ethiopian-Canadian Muslim community in Winnipeg, and Society of Winnipeg, Ethiopian Society of Winnipeg, and SOSIP, Solidarity Committee for Ethiopian Political Prisoners. And at the same time, also we are asking the Canadian government to reconsider a resettlement program which is blocked by now, especially to Ethiopians in general, for Africans. So that kind of protection is important for the refugees who are suffering now.
Ali Said, is there a key point you'd like to make with regard to the reason that Ethiopians in particular are becoming refugees and finding themselves in places like Yemen?
Mike, as you know, to become a refugee is not a choice. It's imposed by those tyrannies, dictators and fascists, and also the corrupt administration. So the Ethiopians and other African refugees are forced to leave their country due to those reasons. Especially the Ethiopians are forced to leave their country by TSIS, which is Tigray State Intelligence Service, and also are being killed and targeted by ISIS in Libya. If you remember a few months ago, and 30 Ethiopians, Islam and Christian, being slaughtered by ISIS. You see, they were forced to leave the country by ISIS and being killed by ISIS. So that's why most the non-profit organization and a government and should consider and to support those refugees and make available for resettlement program.
Okay. Ali Said, thank you very much for sharing this recent development with us.
Thank you, Mike, as usual.
Ali Said, General Secretary of the Solidarity Committee for Ethiopian Political Prisoners.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The conflict in Yemen has been laboring on since March 25th of 2015, and 2.5 months later, the humanitarian catastrophe is immense. Peace talks are slated to begin in Geneva, Switzerland on June 14th, although there seems to be very little prospect of the situation alleviating. So what exactly are the roots of this conflict, and what are the prospects for seeing some sort of a peace? Joining us from Detroit is geopolitical analyst and editor of Pan-African Newswire. His name is Abiyomi Azikiwe. Thank you very much for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I was wondering if you could maybe give us a bit of a sketch of exactly how we got to this point. The bombing campaign from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, backed by the United States, launched their attacks on March 25th. But the roots go back much further than that. In fact, they go back, by my understanding, to the Arab Spring and some of the protests in Yemen that were taking place about 3 to 4 years ago. Do you want to maybe give us a little bit of that background for us?
The country, over the last several years, has been a major focus of U.S. foreign policy in its so-called war on terrorism. There has been the execution of numerous people inside of Yemen, including people who hold U.S. passports and are therefore were considered as U.S. citizens. Also, the issue is considered the poorest and the most underdeveloped state in the Arabian Peninsula, also in the region of the Persian Gulf states. So there are a number of issues related to the contentious atmosphere that exists inside of Yemen itself. Going back, if we want to start in 2011, there was a series of protests inside the country against the former President Saleh, who in fact now has allied with the Ansarullah, the Houthi movement inside of Yemen. His government was held responsible for the widespread poverty and disempowerment, as well as instability inside of Yemen during 2011. And there were mass demonstrations forcing a compromise agreement, which the United States government had a profound role in negotiating, that would, of course, lead to some type of democratic or at least some type of more inclusive system in Yemen. Then that unraveled, particularly over the last year, when the government of the fugitive President Hadi fled to the south of the country in the southern port city of Aden, the strategic area, which has been a focus of the fighting in recent months. Then, as a result of the escalating tensions inside the country, the spreading of the influence of the Ansarullah movement, he fled to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, where he still remains, and is the Saudi Arabian government and the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is advocating on behalf of the fugitive President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi, saying that he is still the legitimate head of state, and that the Houthi movement is, as far as they're concerned, a force that is heavily supported by the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the war itself, as it has developed since March 26, is being portrayed as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council and its allies, backed by the United States on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the Islamic Republic of Iran and its ally in Yemen, being the Ansarullah movement. So this is how the current struggle has been framed. And the parameters of this struggle have regional as well as international implications.
Okay. So could you tell us a little bit more about the Houthi faction here, the Ansarullah movement? Are they one and the same, for starters?
Yeah, the movement, it has been a resistance movement for several years in Yemen. It is allied or considered a part of the Shia Islamic tendency in Yemen. Many people believe this is why the Islamic Republic of Iran has supported them in the struggle, but they have historically been suppressed. They originate, it is said, in the northern regions of the country, and they have been considered a threat to the Saudi GCC overall strategic objectives for the Arabian Peninsula. Now, in recent months, going back to the middle of last year, 2014, the Houthi have extended their influence into the capital of Sana'a. They have taken large swaths of territory, even in the south of the country. So they're considered a direct threat to Saudi influence inside of Yemen, as well as Saudi influence throughout the entire region. So Saudi Arabia has more or less taken up the banner of the United States in Yemen. The U.S. Had been championing the country for the last several months prior to the collapse of their foreign policy in Yemen, saying that it was an example of a success in the so-called war on terrorism, because they have targeted so many people considered as members of the Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula. Many of them were killed. But as our listening audience knows, in most of these drone attacks that have been carried out over the last several years, be it in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia or wherever in the region, many of the people who are killed in these attacks are not the so-called armed combatants or Al-Qaeda operatives or Islamic State operatives or Al-Shabaab operatives, but they tend to be innocent civilians, elders, children, women, men who have nothing to do with these targeted organizations. But the way in which the war on terrorism is covered, they don't examine what is actually takes place on the ground. They have a report saying that this leader or that leader was targeted. They were killed. In some cases, they have to come back weeks or months later and say, well, in fact, they weren't killed. So this is the atmosphere that is prevailing in Yemen. Now, the United States championing Yemen as a success story, of course, when the situation shifted, they did not have the political will or the resources to respond to the expansion of the Ansarullah movement's spreading of influence inside of Yemen, and as well as this alliance with other forces inside the country. So what they did was they withdrew approximately 100 special forces from Yemen. They also withdrew their diplomatic personnel from the country, signaling to Saudi Arabia to go ahead and carry out U.S. foreign policy objectives in Yemen, which to a large degree coincide with those of Riyadh. So this has been the situation since March 26th. And the war, which is not being covered almost at all inside the United States, has been devastating to Yemen and other countries throughout the region. They have engaged in innumerable sorties, bombing missions inside the country. Depending upon the sources that you utilize or cite, anywhere between 2,000 and 4,000 people have been killed. Thousands of others have been dislocated. Many of the people who have been dislocated have taken refuge in Djibouti, which is across the Red Sea in the Horn of Africa. And these people in the thousands are there. And Djibouti, as many people are already aware of, has the largest U.S. military base for the U.S. Africa Command on the African continent. Thousands of U.S. troops are stationed at a camp, Le Monnaie, along with French troops as well. So the U.S. has its hands all over this war. The planes that are being flown The F-15, F-16 aircraft are manufactured by defense companies here in the United States, the General Dynamics Corporation. And also, the U.S. has openly admitted in articles published in the New York Times weeks ago that they were supplying refueling technology to the Saudi GCC fighter bombers. They were also in a situation where they were providing intelligence, even though they claim it's not direct or specific intelligence. The fact of the matter is they are assisting in many ways in carrying out this massive bombing campaign against Yemen.
There's a third player in this drama, and that's Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula and the Islamic State that are active in Yemen. And I'm wondering how that development is interfering or enabling the whole conflict as it's taking place.
Many people believe, and there's strong evidence to suggest, a connection between Saudi Arabia as well as other forces in the Gulf, so-called Gulf Cooperation Council, and Al-Qaeda, as well as the Islamic State. And that is playing itself out in Yemen. The fact of the matter is these so-called Islamist extremist groups have been fighting against the Ansarullah movement, the Shia forces that are politically supported by Iran inside of Yemen. We've seen the most intense fighting in Aden, in the strategic southern port city, where territory has been taken and retaken by both sides. Those forces that appear to be working in alliance with Saudi Arabia and the GCC and the others who are a part of the Ansarullah movement are working in alliance with them, the lawless forces of the Yemeni army, which are still allied with former President Abdullah Saleh. So this is how the situation is being played out. You have also cross-border interventions by the Ansarullah, as well as the Yemeni lawless forces allied with the former President Saleh. There have been numerous attacks over the last several weeks into the eastern region of Saudi Arabia that have killed Saudi troops as well as other Saudi personnel and civilians. So the war is actually becoming more regionalized. Also, there's been a series of bombings of Shia mosques, both in eastern Saudi Arabia, where you have a substantial Shia population, as well as in the capital of Sana'a. So it's taking on a more sectarian character. The struggle is being regionalized. And of course, the United States is playing a key role in this whole process by backing Saudi Arabia, the GCC, and its allies.
Talk a little bit about the prize here itself. I mean, what are the main strategic considerations that the United States in particular wants to maintain control over through Saudi Arabia or other regional allies that's going to maintain this the situation as it's moving forward? That's the background concern here.
Well, there are two major sources of concern as far as Washington and Wall Street are concerned. Aden is right on the Gulf of Aden, which is a very important shipping lane in that region. Billions upon billions of dollars of oil and other resources go through that area every single day, including military hardware. Also, the Red Sea, which is adjacent to the Gulf of Aden, is very important too, because it represents a bridge, more or less than a division, between the Arabian Peninsula and the Horn of Africa. Also, if we look at Saudi Arabia, which has been a close ally of the United States, of course, they have been in partnership with the United States in the oil industry, as well as in the military fear. This is related to the increasing influence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, not only in the Persian Gulf states, but also in the Arabian Peninsula as well. So there's a profound concern, some of it related to the recent negotiations between Washington and European Union members and Iran over its nuclear technology program. But at the same time, it goes beyond that. That is an effort on the part of the imperialist states to contain Iran in terms of its own internal and technological development. And at the same time, they are concerned because the influence of Iran is also an ideological and political one, from the standpoint that the Iranian government came to power over 36 years ago in a popular revolution that was anti-imperialist, that was staunchly against Washington and its influence, not only in Iran, but also throughout the region and indeed the world. And that revolution has been able to sustain itself for the last 3.5 decades. The U.S. has attempted on numerous occasions to destabilize and overthrow the Iranian government, but they have not been successful. They have imposed sanctions, draconian sanctions, against Tehran. And these sanctions have taken a toll on the Iranian economy. So you have also what is labeled as the Shia Crescent, meaning the Islamic Republic of Iran, the various political tendencies inside, for example, Yemen, also inside other countries in the region, including Bahrain, being allied with Syria, which the United States has targeted for regime change over the last 4.5 years, southern Lebanon, where the Hezbollah movement, which is also allied with the Islamic Republic of Iran, has proved itself on the battlefield in regard to its efforts to drive the Israeli Defense Forces out of Lebanon, out of southern Lebanon, defeating them in 2000, and then, of course, again, when they tried to reintervene in 2006. So these alliances, where Tehran appears to be the center, coupled with the outright instability in the Arabian Peninsula, the potential for uprisings in the Arabian Peninsula as well as in the Persian Gulf states, and also the role of the United States Africa Command in Djibouti, all of grave a concern of Washington, as well as Wall Street, because there's a lot at stake in terms of the global oil market, which the United States is increasingly reasserting its dominance through various mechanisms, by internal production, driving down the price of fuel, all over the international community, also driving down prices of other commodities, causing an extreme economic crisis in countries like Russia, and Venezuela, and the Federal Republic of Nigeria, and others who produce oil. So it's a continuation of the effort by the United States in alliance with the European Union to dominate that region of the world, and also to counter Russia, to counter the People's Republic of China, as well as the Islamic Republic of Iran, and their greater cooperation among themselves, their greater alliances, as well as their political influence throughout the world.
Now, during his speech on Capitol Hill in March, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke of the need to control Yemen. So I'm wondering where you see Israel fitting into that larger framework.
The State of Israel targets the Islamic Republic of Iran as the major threat right now in the Middle East. Iran conducts its own independent foreign policy. So therefore, they cannot be controlled or manipulated by Washington or by Tel Aviv. Also, Iran has supported militarily and politically the Hamas resistance movement that is in control of the Gaza Strip. And they have been a formidable source of resistance against the state of Israel for many years now. So they want to, of course, create an atmosphere where actual war is waged directly against the Islamic Republic of Iran. The United States is on board for this war, but there are differences, tactical differences, on how the war against Iran and its influence throughout the region should be waged. The Israelis, on the one hand, advocate a more aggressive war. The United States, on the other hand, carries out a more subtle and a more indirect form of destabilization and war against Iran. I mean, it's clear that the United States is supporting this war that is going on in Yemen. And it's quite obvious that the war in Yemen is heavily directed not only against the Yemeni people, but also against the people of Iran, its government, and its influence throughout the region. So the state of Israel is on board with this war that is being waged. And it's quite interesting that many of these so-called Islamist groups, which have been fighting Hezbollah, for example, where the struggle is intensifying in southern Lebanon on the border with Syria, that they are fighting Syria, also carrying out massive operations in Iraq, have targeted the Shia parties and tendencies in the region and virtually do nothing against the state of Israel in terms of its military operations and even in regard to its propaganda. So this is why many people have reached the conclusion that at least some of these groups are working in conjunction with Washington and Wall Street and also being supported by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar. So it's a part of a broader and perilous scheme to dominate the Middle East and also the African continent.
Now, in a recent article that you wrote just earlier this week, you mentioned that the talks taking place in Geneva on June 14th, and there's already an apparent position that's being staked out by the Saudi Arabian side, saying that essentially recognizing the legitimacy of Hadi and the opposition, the Ansarallah forces, essentially saying that they're illegitimate. Does that not pretty much make any resolution at these talks irreconcilable?
Well, it doesn't start off on a good footing. And even the Associated Press, which I quoted in this article that was published in Global Research, that, quote, Yemen internationally recognized prime minister, meaning Mr. Hadi. And when they say internationally recognized, they mean recognized by the West and by Saudi Arabia. It goes on to say that upcoming United Nations-sponsored peace talks in Geneva are aimed at restoring power to his government and pressuring Shia rebels to withdraw from the capital and other cities. So that's not a good starting point for any set of negotiations, particularly from the standpoint that Hadi was essentially driven out of Yemen. And even though he took refuge in the southern part of Yemen, many Yemenis who are from that region say he does not have substantial support in the south of Yemen as well. So it doesn't start off on a good footing. And it doesn't also mean that the bombing by the Saudi GCC coalition will halt. We saw last month where the Saudi Foreign Ministry announced a pause of 5 days, ostensibly to allow humanitarian relief. And there's no real evidence that this pause took place. The fighting on the ground escalated as well during this period. And humanitarian relief that is being provided to the country is being blocked, either through the bombing of airstrips and also the bombing of ports in Yemen. One Iranian Red Crescent vessel had attempted to deliver humanitarian relief, and it was halted and diverted to the Horn of Africa port at Djibouti, and which is a major base for U.S. military operations in the Horn of Africa. So, yes, I believe that there's a tremendous amount of hurdles to overcome if these peace talks are to have any positive benefit.
Now, this conflict has been described as Saudi Arabia's Vietnam. Like, in the world of real politic, given the factors and the interests that you've outlined in this interview, how realistically do you see this scenario playing out? Are we going to see a balkanized Yemen? Are we going to see a kind of a scorched earth policy? What's the end game here, you think?
At this point, it doesn't appear, despite the fact that for the last 2.5 months, this bombing operation has taken place and has created a lot of hungry people, displaced people, injured people. The hospitals are overwhelmed. The blockade of humanitarian and medical assistance and food is being facilitated by not only Riyadh, but also by Washington. It doesn't appear as if it's built any resolve on the part of the Yemeni people to turn against the Ansarullah and the Hadi forces who they perceive as defending the national sovereignty of Yemen. So they can continue this bombing campaign. They can continue to create havoc and unrest in Yemen. But in the long term, is this a winning strategy for the U.S. Backed forces? That is the real question that is at hand right now. And I'm sure the State Department is trying to ponder over this issue as well. They held talks in Muscat, Oman, just last week with representatives of the Ansarullah, the U.S. State Department. So they're trying to work out some type of compromise to foster some type of face-saving agreement between the Ansarullah and the United States government that would allow the U.S. to re-enter Yemen, at least in an attempt to re-exert its influence inside the country. But that remains to be seen. There are many other variables that are involved in this situation. The United States has its hands full in Iraq. They just announced earlier today, on Thursday, June the 11th, that they were, in fact, sending more so-called advisors or trainers to Iraq, boasting the number to well over 3,500 U.S. forces. Now, this is the same Barack Obama administration who ran for president in 2008, saying they were going to end the Iraq War. And there's now, since last year, been sending troops back into Iraq because their strategy has totally collapsed in Iraq as well. So, yes, I believe that they have to still, in their minds and in their foreign policy formulations, develop a strategy where they can save face in the light of a broadening regional war that is extending not only throughout Yemen, but also into Saudi Arabia.
Well, Abayomi Azikiwe, I'm afraid we're going to have to close there, but I want to thank you very much for helping to shed some light on this severely underreported humanitarian crisis, and look forward to speaking to you again at some point.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with a geopolitical analyst and editor of Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.